Welcome to the Drive Along Podcast, where in each episode I interview a guest uniquely involved in the car culture universe. Today, we have a dedicated car collector with over 50 years of involvement in the hobby, Mr. Steve Sheriff. Steve, how on earth did you get involved in the vintage car business?
Well, I became an enthusiast as soon as I got my driver's license, which was maybe a few weeks after I turned 16 years of age. And I've been a dedicated driving enthusiast ever since. Now, that soon led to getting interested in unusual cars. One point I'd like people to understand is you can start at this hobby at any level. So, for example, I started out with very low cost, cheap indeed, Edsels. Edsels, of course, were the pariah car of the 50s and into the 60s. And they were dirt cheap, they were powerful, and they were interesting cars. So I got started with those cars, which were approximately, you know, 7 or 8 years old at the time, and they represented a very interesting thing to do, and it went from there. So car collectors can start at a easy, low-cost level of something that just interests them. I look back at it, I can't believe it, but I owned every model of Edsel there was, and there were 9 different types of 58 Edsels.
That's
I was just
amazing.
Enthusiastic about Edsels.
Right. What I know and our listeners don't is Edsels over the course of your hobby life have turned into Rolls Royce, haven't they?
Yeah, they became very valuable, but it takes forever for that process to happen.
And yeah, I'm talking more about your current vehicle, like you've.
Oh yeah, no, I graduated along the way as my interest changed. And what's nice about this hobby is your interests can change, and collectors and enthusiasts are interested in all kinds of different types of cars. Thank goodness, so we have lots of variety. I went from Edsels to Corvettes, to all kinds of different types of interesting cars. You know, along the way, it was enjoyable at no matter what level or what type of car I was interested in.
Fantastic. Of course, you know, we met at a car show, and it was a car show that had everything. Well, I don't think that year it had an Edsel, but everything from Corvettes to your current baby, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, a 37 Rolls-Royce?
Yes, it is a 1937 Rolls-Royce, and I've owned it now for 29 years.
Oh, my gosh.
I was just going over it in my mind. You know something? It has never failed to proceed other than momentarily with vapor lock in the fuel system. It has never been on a flatbed. It has never been trailered. It has never, ever let me down. The only time that happened was momentarily. Interestingly enough, a gentleman stopped by the side of the road to help me. Did he ever help me? It turned out he was Michael Andretti's crew chief for the Molson Indy. And the next thing you know, a new set of points, which I carried as a spare, was involved. I haven't touched them since. It was almost as if the Almighty had put new points in my car. One of the interesting things about the hobby is when you have an interesting car, people are interested in it, and they will stop by the side of the road to help you. They will gawk at your car. You got to be careful when you drive these things because people may be so focused on your car that they don't drive safely. But, you know, when you have an interesting car, you tend to bring out smiles in fellow motorists and good things happen.
Yes, absolutely. I can concur with that. Anyone that has any interest in cars, car collecting. There is so much interest in all things British these days with the different television and Netflix shows. When your Rolls-Royce drives by, people stop, they look, and there's a smile on their face. Absolutely true.
And what is very nice is it's good to engage these people, and the public should understand that almost all car collectors are interested in talking to a citizen about their car.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're driving these cars, we're almost never in a rush. I mean, why would you take an exotic car or non-exotic, but why would you take an old car out if you're in a hurry? Almost all the time, the driver would be very interested in talking to you and chatting to you about their car. It's a very social activity.
Yes, definitely.
And I think that the public tend to stand back, and the public say to themselves, oh, this is such a rare and unusual car, I can't talk to the owner. But the owners want to talk to you. Your Burlington Downtown car show proves that again and again. The public want to talk to the owners, and the owners want to talk to the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've definitely been able to match that crossover with that particular show and others as well. The key is to make it accessible and not be intimidating in any way, shape, or form. You are the absolute gentleman when you're out in that car. I've experienced it. You're the first person to let people take a picture with the car and look at it. You'll open the boot of it and show some of the fantastic things you've got in there. Like, you've got a complete set of china, don't you, in the boot of that car?
Yes, I have coronation china because it was the 1937 coronation of King George VI. I also have the correct 44-piece toolkit, so I've got that, the boot, of course, the trunk. There's all kinds of things to talk about. One thing I do, too, is if there are young children with their parents and circumstances permit, I will let the young ones sit behind the steering wheel with their parents looking on. They're surprised I'll do that, but I do that to just generate the right level of communication and enthusiasm, you know?
Well, it's phenomenal that you haven't got stanchions around that vehicle and keeping people 10 feet away with the...
Yeah, but that is exactly the wrong spirit.
Yep.
To sort of create these things as being aloof. I mean, all of these cars at one stage were in general use, okay? With rare exception, these cars were motoring around the streets, engaged in transportation. And to set them off like in a museum, and most museums, of course, these days will allow you to get pretty close, to cordon them off is exactly the wrong idea. The Cobble Beach Concours, which is the premier, the best concours in Canada for vintage and antique cars, it's quite the show. No cars there are cordoned or stanchioned off. There might be one or two in a field of 115, 120. The right approach is to allow the public respectful access, and almost invariably the public respond by treating these cars properly.
With the proper respect. Steve, yeah. For our listening audience, what is the definition of a concourse?
Well, a concourse is really a beauty show for cars. It started in France with an emphasis on style, started really early 20s and went onwards. It has evolved into being a display of very unusual and often rare cars, but not always. And what is interesting about the concourse is it then evolved into judging. Not all concours are judged, but most are. And it's called a concourse d'élégance, the d'élégance that gives away its purpose. Originally, there was a kind of a fashion statement made. Owners and passengers were dressed up in costumes of the era. In fact, originally, brand new cars, exotic brand new cars, were part of the concourse, but not anymore. In a typical high-quality concourse in North America, the cars are going back very, very old, 1903, 4, and so on. The cutoff is often 1973, so the cars are older cars.
Interesting.
And what is interesting about this is they are judged for condition, authenticity, and cleanliness. Authenticity is big. In most concours, the judges want to see the car as it sat in the showroom. How close is your car to the way it was delivered new in the showroom? Which is a real challenge.
Well, it'd be phenomenal for an age of car such as your 1937 Rolls-Royce.
Right.
I mean,
I have been very honored to receive quite a few interesting awards for that car, and to be scored out of 100, the highest score I've ever realized is 99.1 points out of 100, which took a long time to achieve because, you know, it involves research, it involves, you know, a fair amount of commitment and dedication, but it doesn't have to be done overnight. So what right. happens is that these cars are always works in progress. It is hardly ever done, except by speculators, to buy a vehicle, put sort of a cocoon around it, and try and resell. That is not what the hobby is all about.
Hence why you call it a hobby.
Right. I call it a hobby. And it is, these cars are not bought for investment. It is a mistake for someone who is going into this hobby to think that they are going to get rich or they are going to have own the car to make money. Repairs and maintenance will vacuum up any profits you might make. Trying to pick the right cars to profit on is a hit and miss, and it involves luck. Car collectors ought not to be confused with investors or speculators.
Good point. They become pieces of art, but we're not talking about a Christie's auction here. We're talking about love of the sport, of the hobby, and vehicles that are represented basically on personal interest.
Right. You have to like the car. There is no point in getting a car that you're not particularly attracted to just so you can say you own it or you're hoping to flip it at a profit. That is definitely not what the hobby is all about,
right,
and is a mistake.
Getting back to concourse, I assume everyone, are you invited to enter a concourse, or do you have to submit information? How do you end up in one?
A couple of ways. Some concourse are open because you are a member of a club, such as the Antique and Classic Automobile Association of America. And if you are a member of that club, which is easy to join, and you have a car that is old enough, generally 25 years or older, you are allowed to attend no matter what your car is, or indeed no matter what condition it's in, because everybody appreciates that these cars are either on the road to being restored or have been restored and are in a gentle decline until their next time that they're touched up or restored. So that's sort of one type of concourse. Another type of concourse is an invitational, which means that you have to apply, send pictures, and describe your car, and then the selection committee decides whether your car is appropriate for their concourse. I have been privileged to be involved in the selection process. I'm not part of the committee, but I source cars for the Cobble Beach concourse. The invitational system is different. And then you have the club concourse. Like, for example, I'm the chief judge of the Jaguar Club of Ontario. If you own a Jaguar, you are entitled to enter that in our concourse, regardless of the vintage. So we have Jaguars rarely, but they could theoretically come from the 30s all the way up to a brand new Jaguar. And you can enter a Jaguar in our concourse because we have classes for that wide range. Now I'm calling these a MARQ club, M-A-R-Q-U-E. In a MARQ club, which is like the Oldsmobile club or the Corvette club or the Jaguar club, you are entitled to enter once you're a member of the club, which is simple to do.
I see.
So you have general clubs where anybody can belong to a multi-make club. You have specific MARQ clubs that will get you, those will both get you into concourse, well-regarded concourse, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the invitational concourse, which are all over North America, where you apply and they decide whether your car is appropriate. And it might be that your car is appropriate this year but wasn't last year because of the theme of that year. It doesn't mean that because they reject you, you know, that you're doomed forever. It just means that they think you're a good fit for this year's show.
Yes, I thought that some organizers either spotlight a particular MARQ or a particular era and invite the vehicles that so a representative of sort of their vision for the show for that year.
Right. And one should never take offense at this. And there are a few, inevitably, because that's human nature, entrants are fixed on winning at all costs. That is exactly the wrong attitude. The right attitude is to enter the show, enjoy yourself, enjoy talking to fellow owners, enjoy talking to the spectators, and learn. Many concourse, but not all, will give you score sheets. The judges are evaluating your car, and that's a blueprint to future improvements.
Oh, I see. So you might have scored lower in a particular area because it wasn't original or original to, as you said, a showroom spec.
Right, or the condition of the part or the area wasn't up to snuff. So what happened, before I got my 99.1 score at the Classic Car Club of America show when I got a senior award there, before I got that, I had been maybe in 15 to 20 concours with that 37 Rolls Royce.
My gosh, that many.
Oh, yeah. and for fun, and I would improve all the time. And I would keep a list of, okay, the judges found this to be wrong. And they're usually right. They're not always right, but they're usually right. And so, okay, I better improve this. And then I would gradually improve this. As a funny aside, I was in the Rolls-Royce Owners Club of America. Mm-hmm. What happened there is that's a mark show, of course, a model show, Rolls-Royces and Bentleys only. So one year, a judge went underneath my car. It's fairly high underneath. He was under there probably for about 15 minutes, which is amazing.
15 minutes?
15 minutes. He had only worked on Rolls-Royces prior to World War II, believe it or not. He was a guru, an expert. 15 minutes later, he comes out, and he's got a long list of things that need to be done. And he found a Q-tip that I had dropped somehow. I was cleaning something. And they don't put all those lists on the score sheet. But after I was judged, I asked him, could I please have the benefit of your list? He said, sure. He gave me the list. The next show, I think this next one was in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm there again with my car. I trailered it.
Uh-huh.
He's there. Under he goes. And he's under, you know, for a very long time. Not as long as the last time. Comes out. And I had deliberately, for a joke, I had planted 6 Q-tips throughout the bottom of the car.
No.
Guess what? He found all 6. And then he says to me, it's perfect. You've corrected everything on the list. I said, well, thank you for the list. I have. So because of his eagle eye and because he was so kind, I created a perfect undercarriage of the car. It was not easy to do.
My gosh.
But there's an example how the judging system and the pursuit of perfection, you don't have to get obsessed about this, you just take your time. But there's an example how the pursuit of perfection eventually netted me a score of 99.1. It would have been higher, but I had a burned bulb in one of the courtesy lights on the car.
Oh my gosh.
but who cares? At that stage, you are getting just about where it was in the showroom. Now, concours differ. Some concours, it has to be the way your car was in the showroom, which is the Rolls-Royce standard. In other concours, it's the way your car could have been in the showroom. In other words, could it have had certain options, mind you, at that time, at the time it was in the showroom, could it have had certain options? Well, eventually, for fun and enjoyment, I put certain options into my car, such as a tachometer, rare to do. When I did that, I did it exactly correctly, and this was an ultra-rare option. It was available on Bentleys, hardly ever on Rolls-Royces. As soon as I did that, I knew that I would lose points if I were to come back into Rolls-Royce judging in the Mark show, because, of course, my car didn't have a tachometer in the showroom. But I didn't care. I thought this was a nice thing to have, and I like having tachometers. And sure enough, in the invitational shows, where the standard is, could it have been that way, I did very, very well. And judges on a number of major shows said, yeah, you've satisfied us that it could have been this way.
Interesting.
But it's all good fun. And I could take it back to a Rolls-Royce show. I won some serious awards in their judging, but I should go back knowing that I'm going to get a deduction. So what? It's just a great experience. They usually have seminars. They always do. They have tours if you want to participate, which is nice. So you should never get obsessed about winning or what your score is. The score is just a challenge to make the car better. It's not something to get all excited about.
That's a very interesting and progressive way of looking at it. It's not a race. There's not one winner. Basically, you're there to enjoy the experience, enjoy the car, and learn what isn't completely up to snuff or judged to be up to snuff, and take it as you call it, a scorecard for continuous improvement.
When you get into the marquee or mark judging, you tend to get judges who are very, very knowledgeable about your car. And you are bound to learn from those judges because they probably owned your car or something like it or have restored it. So I find that mark-specific concours are very interesting from that point of view. If you want to improve your car and do it properly, you are in the presence of experts.
Right.
With some cars, I have gradually entered the realm where I would say I qualify as such, as a judge and so on, but only with some cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody can be an expert in all makes or all models, but it sure is nice to talk to an expert if you know, if you have a car of that type.
Absolutely, I can understand that. Just everything from general interest, or you may have a specific question about something that you haven't been able to find to replace, or something that you
right.
just don't completely understand function or where it goes.
Right. When I was at a show, a big invitational concourse called the Glenn Moore Gathering in Ohio, very, very knowledgeable judges were judging my car, and they were shocked that I had the correct feeler gauge for my car, which has on each blade of the gauge stamped on it what it's for. These things are rare as hen's teeth. And one of the judges, very knowledgeable, because I've got 44 tools in this kit.
Right.
Number. He said, where on earth did you get this feeler gauge? And I said, I got this feeler gauge in New Zealand. He said, wow. How long did it take you to get it? I said, years, years and years. And I said that initially the gentleman who quoted me the money, I just said, I can't afford it. It's too much money. He said, okay, send me some pictures of your car and sort of a description of what it's like and what kind of shows you've been at, and we'll talk. After he saw what my car was all about, he ended up charging me one-third of the original price, only because of that. Only because he knew I was a true enthusiast, only because he knew I had a respectable car. So the judges, they, some of them really, really know your car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the better your car is, and the more the judge knows, the better the whole thing is.
And round it goes. So that's an amazing story. So the gentleman in New Zealand, basically, if you were just a whatever, he was going to make money, but in that you proved you were a fellow enthusiast, he shared his wealth with you, basically.
Right. Well, he told me he wanted to see, make sure I wasn't a dealer.
Ah.
See, he wanted to make sure I wasn't just getting this for profit. And when I satisfied him that by then, at that time, I think I'd owned the car probably over well over 20 years by then. I've owned it almost 30 now. When he was satisfied that I'm the real deal and I own this car and I show it, that I am a true enthusiast, okay, now I get the enthusiast price.
Right, of course. Steve, you're so ensconced in the whole show and concourse, restoration and vintage vehicle. If someone were interested in dipping their toe in, because we know once they dip their toe in, they'll fall in face first, but how would one go about in their local area, find out either about a show or about a club, or how would you suggest someone that was right. interested would get involved?
Right. Well, thanks to the internet, you can easily find clubs of the type that you're interested in, but you might not be, might not have sort of thought enough about what kind of cars you are interested in, which is fine. So in the summer, starting in the spring and moving into summer, I guess finishing up just before October, there are a lot of cruise nights. And these are events which are informal. They're off usually at shopping plazas, and people bring their cars out informally to just talk and dialogue with each other. And there's a wide variety of cars there. Nobody's judging anything. They're just there for fun. There's often period music playing. Everybody's having a good time and a happy mood. That is a good place. So if you have an interest in a certain make, let's say a Mustang, okay, by all means, join the Mustang Club. It is very important to do that, because then you can get in touch with guys who might know where a certain type is, or they can educate you on the different types of Mustangs, their values, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Not that far along, a cruise night, and you could easily look under cruise nights sort of near me online, or cruise nights Mississauga, or Oakville, or whatever, and you'll find that often Friday nights, Saturday nights, in shopping plazas, you might have 100 cars out there.
Steve, for our listeners, cruise night actually isn't cruising, is it?
No, it's not. Cruise night, correct, wrong. A cruise night is a static display where owners park their cars, and then everybody wanders around looking at their cars. Often they leave the hoods open so people can talk about the car, talk with the owner, and talk with each other. So I can't think of a better way to sort of dip your toe in than to have a look at a variety of cars. Once you go to a few cruise nights, you might get an idea of the kind of car you'd like to own. And by the way, you don't have to own a car to be participate in this fun. You don't have to. You just go to shows and go to cruise nights. Some people do that.
Just for the pure enjoyment.
That's right. Because when you own a collector car, one of the problems is getting proper indoor storage. You don't want to be having a collector car sit out in the winter, in the Canadian winter, if you can help it.
Right.
So if you are not able, economically at a certain stage in your life, financially, to make the investment, although it could be reasonably modest, I mean, these cars are not usually daily drivers. So if you're not able to make or willing to make that commitment at that stage, so what? You participate in the hobby. You can belong to a car club without owning that type of car. Mm-hmm. And you'll meet other owners. They'll take you for drives. You can just be an enthusiast. Car clubs welcome enthusiasts. You don't have to be an owner.
So involvement is simple as a little bit of research and a couple of emails or phone calls. And someone who had up to this point never really been involved in the hobby of owning, collecting, or being involved with classic and vintage cars. It's as simple as that, then.
It is. And I strongly recommend that. Many people make the mistake of buying the car first and then joining the club. That is the wrong way around. You should join a club first, and then with the advice of people in the club who are invariably willing to help you and are interesting people. One of the advantages of membership in a club, car club, is you meet very interesting people. And
right.
You find that you start out with the common bond of the cars, but very soon you make friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great form of social activity, and it's, you can make some lifelong lasting friendships. And the qualifications are simply being interested. All you got to do is be interested, and you're in.
Fantastic. Steve, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your history and your over 30 years of owning a Rolls-Royce and 50 years of being in, as you call it, the hobby, vintage and classic car collecting. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a bootful of information about being involved in the hobby or enjoying it at many different levels.
Thank you, Ron. Ron, a few more points if I could.
Of course.
One thing to realize is that insurance on these cars is low cost and is excellent. One of the leading companies now in North America is Hagerty Insurance, and Hagerty will insure your car for what is called an agreed value. So basically, you and Hagerty agree what your car should be worth. And then if something happens to it, without question, that's the number they pay if it gets written off, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
So insurance is low cost and it's excellent because they realize that you're not usually driving these cars all over the place as a daily driver. Also, bear in mind that if you're starting out in the hobby and you want to be an owner, start with a car that has wide parts availability and club support. So, for example, owning a Mustang would be an excellent idea. The club is active, parts are readily available. That is a good move. If you're into real antiques, and the Model A clubs, believe it or not, are very, very active, widely parts available because they're reproduced with good club supports. Most collector cars are much simpler than conventional cars these days, particularly they don't have complex electronics or computer systems, which makes them much easier to service. And a lot of them are do-it-yourself, or can be handled by mechanics who don't need a data bank of computers.
Right. And so in other words, start with a Mustang or a Pontiac Parisienne, not a Jensen Interceptor.
Correct. But start there. You could morph into the Jensen, but get a grounding in the hobby with something that's easier. Don't take on a 1937 Delahaye as your first car. And a thought on some guides for valuation. Now, if you want to know what these cars should be worth, Hagerty publishes an online value guide called the Hagerty Value Guide, and it lists values for cars free to join. And what happens is they grade the car by condition levels, conditions 1 to 5, 1 being superb, top of the world concourse, 5 being a parts car. And getting to understand condition levels would be helpful. And I'm just going to list the factors briefly that affect value.
Mm-hmm.
What affects value is rarity can affect it if there is low production of the vehicle. If it's a desirable vehicle, if the vehicle was poorly regarded from new, well, then its rarity will be because nobody likes it. So I'm talking about cars that are rare because they're somewhat exotic. Generally, cars that are popular new are going to have good value, because popular new often means popular now.
Okay.
If the roof goes down, if it's a convertible, value can go up. It might go up double. It might. Some cars do that, some don't. But convertibles are almost always worth more than a comparable sedan.
Interesting.
Top-of-the-line options are very desirable. So, for example, if you are buying a car, a plain Jane car like a Chevrolet Biscayne with no options will be worth less money than a loaded Chevrolet Impala. However, the Impala might be more fun to own and might not cost that much more.
Mm-hmm.
So a top-of-the-line options are good for value. The performance of the car is obviously a factor, particularly more and more, not just how fast does it go, a muscle car is a good example, but can it handle and what kind of braking performance does it have? People are more and more interested in that, as they should be. Another factor, is it the first of the model or the last of the model? The first of the model represents breakthrough and innovation. The last of the line means that they've sort of hopefully perfected the car and it'll have fewer problems. So first or last are generally more desirable. The craftsmanship of the building of the car is good. My Rolls-Royce, my old Rolls-Royce is an example of that. And another factor I've listed is that cars are more valuable if they represent some advance, such as the introduction of disc brakes, or if they have some historical significance, like the first car of a unibody body style of that type, or some car that has some significance in history. I'm not saying that a Chrysler K car is there, but it but ironically, it had historical significance. It saved the Chrysler company.
That it did.
A 49 or 50 Ford has a bit of significance because it saved the Ford Motor Company. So those are sort of a short list of factors that make a car more valuable to buy and to own. But once again, I stress, don't get into this because you want to make money. Get into this because you want to enjoy yourself and meet interesting people.
Understood and well said. Steve, this has been very enlightening. It's really great to connect with you and your knowledge. Any of our listeners are going to recognize you as a very knowledgeable expert. Thank you for your time today. I guess once we get through this winter, happy motoring.
Thank you, Ron. And your listeners are welcome to rendezvous with me once again, because I love your Burlington Downtown Car Show. I've had my Rolls Royce there twice, as you know, the 37. When your next show is done, I'll have that 37 there, and your listeners are welcome to talk to me. And if they tell me that you've listened to this podcast and you're still willing to talk to me, I'll make sure that they can sit in the car in the rear seat. Just tell me, look, I've listened to Ron Baker's podcast, and I want to sit in your car, Mr. Sheriff. Done.
That's a deal. Thank you, Steve.
Take care, Ron.
If you have a company, product, or service that could benefit from being a part of the Drive Along podcast, please contact us at www.drivenorg.com/podcast or email us at info@drivenorg.com.